This is VOA News Flying Remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Approximately 284,000 people have died globally from COVID-19, and the number of confirmed cases is nearly 4.2 million. In the United States, 81,000 plus have died, and there are well over 1.3 million confirmed infections. Top White House officials said Sunday they expect the U.S. unemployment rate could reach 25% before the world's biggest economy begins to improve. Currently, it's at 14.7%. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin told Fox News Sunday that the reported numbers are probably going to get worse before improving in the second half of the year and into 2021. White House Economic Advisor Kevin Hassett told CBS News Face the Nation that he's expecting a jobless rate north of 20%, with millions more laid off workers filing for unemployment compensation in May and June. Trump administration officials spoke optimistically about a relatively quick rebound from the coronavirus Sunday as life within the White House reflected the stark challenges still posed by the pandemic. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin predicted the American economy would rebound in the second half of the year from unemployment rates that rival the Great Depression. Vice President Mike Pence is self-isolating after an aide tested positive for the coronavirus last week. An administration official says that Mr. Pence is voluntarily keeping his distance from other people in line with CDC guidance. The official says that Mr. Pence has repeatedly tested negative for COVID-19 since his exposure, but is following the advice of medical officials. Pence's move comes on the heels of three members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force of placing themselves in quarantine. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. As President Donald Trump tries to move on from the coronavirus, Congress is rushing to fill the void and prepare the country for the long fight ahead. Compelled by the lack of comprehensive federal planning, as states begin to reopen, lawmakers of both parties, from the senior-most senators to the newest House member, are jumping in to develop policies and unleash resources to prevent a second wave. In the House and Senate, lawmakers are pushing sweeping proposals for a national virus testing strategy. One seasoned Republican wants a warlike public health fund. A New Jersey freshman launched neighboring colleagues on a regional bipartisan task force to help guide northeastern states back to work. New South Wales, Australia's largest state, will begin loosening its lockdown measures Friday. Cafes and restaurants will be allowed to seat 10 patrons at a time, outdoor gatherings of up to 10 people, and visits of up to 5 people to a household will be permitted. Playgrounds and outdoor pools will also be allowed to reopen with strict limits. Weddings, which had been restricted to 2 guests, will be able to host up to 10, and indoor funerals will be allowed to have 20 mourners. New South Wales has been hit worst by the coronavirus in Australia, with about 45% of the country's confirmed cases and deaths. It recorded just 2 new cases Saturday out of nearly 10,000 people tested. The World Health Organization has suspended its operations in the main Houthi-held areas of Yemen to pressure the rebel group to be more open about suspected coronavirus cases. They include the Yemeni capital and Hodeidah, the country's main port on the Red Sea. The Yemeni government reports 51 COVID-19 cases and 8 deaths in parts of Yemen it controls, but the WHO suspects the Houthis of withholding information about the coronavirus toll in places it controls, including the capital and other big cities. The WHO says it's treating Yemen as if there is a full-blown COVID-19 outbreak. WHO says that there are credible threats and perceived risk for its staff. A leading scientific advisor to the British government said Sunday that drug companies should not be allowed to make big profits from any medication that effectively tackles the COVID-19 virus. Peter Horby, a professor of emergency infectious diseases at Oxford, said the poorest people in the world should have easy access to drugs like remdesivir if proven effective. Horby, speaking on the BBC's Andrew Marr show, said the solution could include the use of more than one antiviral to kill off the virus, coupled with other medications to tackle inflammation caused by the body's reaction to foreign bodies. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan cross-border truck drivers say they are targets of attacks for allegedly spreading COVID-19.
Drivers are not allowed to stop anywhere. It is like the community along the routes have been incited against us. You stop somewhere, you are being pelted by stones.
The BCG vaccine gets another look amid COVID-19 pandemic. Malawi's election commissioners remain defiant despite repeated calls to step down. A second journalist flees Eswatini because he says his life was in danger. We'll also get reaction from the Royal Eswatini police. And Lesotho's ruling coalition may be on the brink of collapse.
As I speak, RCN, which is the junior coalition partner, has already written the letter. It is going to be read on Monday that it's also leaving the coalition.
Motelantua Lepsa is the deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition Democratic Congress Party. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Truck drivers transporting essential goods across the East Africa region say they are having a rough time at border points, especially the Uganda and Rwanda borders. The drivers say most of them are attacked on the way by locals and police officers who accuse them of spreading COVID-19. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, one Kenyan driver transporting fertilizer says he was gang raped by people who were said to be Ugandan police officers.
The people are running away from us. They are saying, if you see a Kenyan truck, somebody will alight from that truck is COVID-19 itself.
The Kenyan truck drivers picking goods from the port of Mombasa to other East African countries are facing hostility at the border points and while on their way to their destinations. Boy Juma, a Kenyan oil counter driver, said that on his way to South Sudan through Uganda, the local community and the police harassed him, making the travel difficult.
Drivers are not allowed to stop anywhere. It is like the community along the routes have been incited against us. You stop somewhere, you are being pelted by stones. The community has become very hostile on us. Just go and stop anywhere that you are feeling tired and you want to stop anywhere. It is very difficult.
It took most drivers up to 7 days to reach their destinations before COVID-19 pandemic outbreak. Unlike now, where most of them are taking between 7 to 14 days awaiting to be tested before proceeding to their destination. Juma says the congestion at the borders exposes them to the virus and that most of them have already exhausted their mileage allowances, making it difficult for them to survive.
At the moment, drivers are leaving themselves in the bushes. There is no food. We are not being allowed to go to hotels. We have just been confined into our trucks and parking bay.
Don't incite your people against foreign drivers who are coming from Kenya, Tanzania or so. We are also facing challenges. If it was our wish, we would also like to stay at home.
At Katuna-Gatuna border of Uganda and Rwanda, foreign drivers are not allowed to cross to Rwanda. Kenyan driver Kemani Njoroge was forced to give his truck to a Rwandese who is assigned by the state to take the goods to its destination, failure to which one has to pay up to $500 and be escorted by officers who monitor the foreign driver's moves.
Because I'm giving another truck driver to deliver the cargo instead of me, so that I will remain in the border until that driver return my truck, then I proceed journey back to Kenya. If you refuse to exchange the driver, what you need to do is to pay $500 so that you can be given the escort. They take you to the destination. You are not authorized to move out from the yard.
The Kenyan government has made it mandatory for all truck drivers to undergo COVID-19 test before leaving for their destinations, promising a smooth move, but this seems not to be working for them. Yesterday, Sunday, Director of Public Health Francis Kuria said that all truck drivers will be tested 48 hours before they embark on their journey to neighboring countries. Kuria says the drivers will only make a stop at a designated point.
For any truck driver who starts his journey today must have had test for 8 hours before starting the journey. So if you are a truck driver and you intend to travel to Malaba tomorrow, you may not do this because there will be checkpoints along the way that will be checking whether you have been tested and confirmed COVID negative.
Kenya and Tanzania are leading in the number of COVID-19 cases in the region. as Kenya records 672 COVID-19 positive cases, 239 recoveries, and 32 deaths as per yesterday, Sunday. Reporting for Viewers Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The BCG vaccine, normally given to babies to protect them from tuberculosis, is getting another look in terms of how it might protect against other infections, including possibly COVID-19. A study in 2000 by Dr. Peter Abbey at the Bandam Health Project in Guinea-Bissau reported a significant reduction in mortality that was much higher in preventing TB alone than could be explained. A 2017 update of the same study found that BCG was reducing rates of respiratory disease in babies. Now, Dr. Abbey's research in Guinea-Bissau is getting more attention as trials for BCG's effect on COVID-19 kicks off in Europe and the United States. Dr. Abbey spoke to Ricky Stryak about his findings.
Is that we have shown that, particularly together with the Dutch immunologists, we have shown that BCG has the capacity to control other infections. It was created to control tuberculosis, but it also reduces the severity or the viral load of other infections.
There's a 2005 study that you guys did in Guinea-Bissau, I believe, that found that it reduced, there was a reduction in lower respiratory tract infections in BCG-vaccinated children.
I can say all of the live vaccines that we have studied have this capacity to particularly, they work best in relation to respiratory infection. And the work on BCG started with doing trials among the newborn children at the Simon Mendes Hospital. So we have been randomizing particular low birth weight children to BCG, and the official policy is not to give BCG. So we have been giving them, randomizing them to BCG versus no BCG, and then they'll only get the BCG later. And the result of those studies are that roughly there's 38% reduction in neonatal mortality. So in mortality in the first month of life. It's a very big reduction. And these are three trials we have done over a period between 2002 and 2013. So it's kind of a long investment in this. And what it indicates is that BCG works against, you know, the main risk of mortality in the first month of life is neonatal sepsis. Mm-hmm. And so BCG reduces the severity of sepsis, and it also works against lower respiratory infection.
Is there a concern that with the increased look on BCG vaccines and whether they are helpful in the fight against COVID, that this could affect the supply chain to children in places like Guinea-Bissau who very much need this vaccine for other issues besides COVID?
I'll be frank and say that's true, but it's sort of a misplaced concern at this moment. The big problem here will be that due to the COVID, a lot of the African countries will have delayed their vaccination program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a far bigger problem, in the sense that a lot of children will be unvaccinated now, or they will get the vaccines later. And that implies not just BCG, but it also implies measles vaccine and OPV vaccines, which are all very, have very beneficial effects.
That was Dr. Peter Abbey, founder of Bandam Health Project in Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Copenhagen. The political crisis in Lesotho could deepen further today, Monday, after Mbatho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane did not comply with the Saturday deadline given by Parliament for him to resign. Now, it appears the four-party ruling coalition led by the All Basotho Convention ABC Party may totally collapse by the end of today, Monday. The 80-year-old Thomas Thabane is under pressure to resign following the murder of his former wife, in which he and his current wife are allegedly implicated. They have denied the accusations. Mr. Thabane said this past Thursday that he will leave office, but in July. Motalentwa Lepsa, deputy leader of Lesotho's Opposition Democratic Congress Party, says the current coalition government may collapse by the end of today, Monday.
The prime minister has not yet resigned, and seemingly he won't resign. He's so stubborn. The next step is for the parliament to make sure that he leaves the office.
It appears there is a coalition within the ruling All Basotho Convention Party.
As of today, how is that coalition holding up?
The four-party coalition, which is led by the Prime Minister now, is in tatters. Let me tell you that ABC wrote a letter, and that letter was read in Parliament on Friday, in which they stated very clearly that they are leaving the coalition. And now you are left with three parties. I'm telling you today that BNP has already written the letter, which is going to be read to on Monday, that they are leaving the coalition. Now we are left with two parties. Let me tell you again that as I speak, RCL, which is the junior coalition partner, has already written the letter. It is going to be read on Monday that it's also leaving the coalition. They used to call it 4x4 coalition. You can be sure that after those three left the coalition, you won't have the coalition anymore.
Last week, Thursday, the Prime Minister agreed to retire at the end of July this year. Where does your party stand on this offer?
The position of my party is so clear. The Prime Minister should have resigned last year, at least. It is by the grace of God that he is in the office even today. The sooner he quits, the better. July is just too far. If things go the way they are now, my party will be upfront in making sure that we push him out. We can't wait for July. We can't wait for July. That is just way too far away from what we can expect. So we are pushing him out.
Some of the Prime Minister's supporters are supporting the idea of immunity. In other words, the Prime Minister should be given a dignified way out. Your response?
I don't understand what this dignified way is. But if it means immunity, no, it's not what we are going to support. Everybody should account for whatever deeds they involve themselves in when they're in the office. We are not going to support any immunity. And if that is what they label a dignified way of leaving the office, they should forget. They can't get the support of my party.
Mutalentwa Lebsa is the deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition, Democratic Congress Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 11th. In Malawi, members of the National Elections Commission, also known as MEC, remain intransigent despite calls for them to resign after two higher court rulings saying that the 2019 presidential election which they supervised was fraught with irregularities. The latest ruling was handed down last Friday by the country's Supreme Court of Appeal, confirming a constitutional court ruling in February this year, nullifying the results of the May 2019 election. But the Election Commission, led by Justice Jean Ansa, says its members were appointed to serve until the end of June this year. Luke Tembo is the National Coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition.
The Human Rights Defenders Coalition, we've been calling for the resignation of Jane Ansa and her fellow commissioners at the Malawi Electoral Commission for the past 9 months. She's been arguing and saying that we were doing a mob justice on her, and she asked to wait for the determination of the courts. The Constitutional Court determined in February that she was with fellow commissioners incompetent, the sentiment that have also been determined by the Supreme Court. So it's only proper and logical for her to just own her words. She said that she would resign upon the determination of the Supreme Court. The issue is straightforward. She's been found incompetent, and we think that she cannot, with her fellow commissioners, be allowed to preside over the second July presidential elections.
Commissioner Linda Kunji was quoted in the Malawi Yansa Times newspaper as saying that she and her fellow commissioners will stay on until their contract expires in June this year. Why not allow them to stay on?
But the problem is we don't have the luxury of time to allow them to hang on up until June. We only have the elections on 2nd of July. So it's proper for her and the fellow commissioners to step down now and allow for the new commissioners to come in and familiarize themselves and prepare for the elections. It will be too late for Malawi to wait for them to step down upon the expiry of their term of office. So as HRDC, we are calling for their resignation now. for them to allow space and time for the new commissioners to come in and prepare for the forthcoming presidential elections.
Let's assume that Jay Ansah and the other members of the Elections Commission resign today. Who will conduct the July 2nd election?
The process of constituting a commissioner at the Malawi Electoral Commission is very clear. This will mean that different political parties which have got representation in parliament will nominate candidates for the position of commissioner at the Electoral Commission. I believe that different political parties stand ready with their proposed candidates for consideration for positions at the Malawi Electoral Commission. If they resign today, we will have enough time to make sure that Malawi has got new commissioners that have followed the due processes of the law.
Luke Tembo is the national coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. A second journalist in less than a month has fled the southern African kingdom of Eswatini, alleging government intimidation and threat to harm him. Journalist Eugene Dube called us to say he fled Eswatini early Tuesday morning, May 5th, after royal police came to his house for the third time within a month to say he was wanted for interrogation. Late last month, Dwele Martin Dramini, editor of the Swaziland News, told VOA he fled Eswatini after he said police had been ordered to assassinate him for writing that King Mswati III had contracted the coronavirus and that the government was not forthcoming with information. Now, journalist Eugene Dube said his only offense was that his newspaper carried a story about the newly formed Economic Freedom Fighters Party in Eswatini.
The Eswatini police had threatened to deal with me after the police commissioner said that he will deal with the two editors, myself, Eugene Dube, and also the editor of another publication, Zweli Martin Dlamini. So the police came to my homestead for several times, to be specific, four times, because even today they came to my homestead, but I have left for South Africa. The reason I have left is that my life was in danger. The police alleged that I had written a critical story on the king. My sin was that I had given a platform to one of the radical political groups, the newly formed Economic Freedom Fighters of Swaziland. The police told me that the king was not happy about the story because it promotes democracy. The EFF of Swaziland was trying to say the Kingdom of Eswatini must have a multi-party democracy and must have a constitutional monarch, not an absolute monarch as we have today.
Let me say that we spoke with Sabelo Dlamini, the acting spokesperson for the Eswatini government. He said the police came to your home to execute a search warrant in relation to contravention of COVID-19 regulations and that you were taken for questioning and release. Did you contravene any coronavirus regulations?
The government spokesperson is just lying. I've never been questioned on breaching any regulations of the COVID-19. It's news to me. The police officers detained me for a whole day, for more than 10 hours. There is nothing like that which was mentioned about breaching regulations of the COVID-19. And if there was any evidence to that, the police would have charged me. So they failed to charge me. The only story they complained about, it was a political story whereby they alleged that I criticized the king.
So where are you at this moment?
Right now, I managed to escape to South Africa using the informal crossing. I had to cross an overflowing river to get to South Africa. Fortunately for me, the soldiers didn't notice me on both sides in South Africa and in Swaziland. Right now, I'm hiding in a certain location I cannot disclose at the moment.
Eugene Dube is an Eswatini journalist who said he fled the country because his life was in danger. He said he was speaking with us from South Africa. Pindile Vilakati, Chief Information and Communication Officer of the Royal Eswatini Police, says police visited journalist Eugene Dube's home to assist in an ongoing investigation, but she says Dube was never arrested.
Eugene Dube is indeed wanted by police to assist in an ongoing investigation, and it is true that his place was visited by police in execution of a search warrant, and some items were seized pending investigation.
He said he fled the country after police visited his home for the third time. In fact, he was saying, as of today, that there were still armed police at his home. Is this true, and why are the police at his home?
Presently, there's no police officer deployed at his residence.
When we last spoke, you said that the Eswatini government believes in free press, and journalist Eugene Dube, if he ever felt that the police did not do its job properly, that he should seek legal recourse. Do you think if he comes back to Eswatini that he will be able to get due process in the court of law?
The investigations are not targeting him as a journalist, but focusing in an act that is unlawful, and as a citizen in the country, without categorizing him to any class, as it is enshrined in the fundamental rights that all persons must be treated equally.
Pindile Vilakati is the Chief Information and Communication Officer of the Royal Eswatini Police. She was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Ghana, where the communications director for the Ghana Football Association, Harry Asante Twon, has disclosed that the body has not received its share of the FIFA relief fund. The world governing body, FIFA, in the final week of last month, confirmed that it is going to share $150 million amongst its member associations to help them mitigate the financial burden of the coronavirus pandemic. Though the money is expected to help the Ghana FA with its operational costs, clubs in the country are pushing the body to let them benefit. But the communications director, Harry Asante, insists that the money is not even in yet. And now to Cote d'Ivoire, where Didier Drogba's campaign to become president of the Ivorian Football Federation has received a huge shot in the arm after former Ivory Coast captain Yaya Touré threw his support behind the Chelsea legend. According to the former Manchester City and Barcelona midfielder, Didier Drogba is the right man to lead the organization going forward. Yaya Touré, who succeeded Didier Drogba as Ivory Coast captain in 2014, said it's time for change in Ivorian football because it needs modernity. Didier Drogba's hope of becoming the president of the Ivory Coast FA suffered a massive blow at the end of April when he secured zero votes for members of the Association of Former Ivorian Footballers. In tennis news, Tennis South Africa chief executive Richard Glover says tennis in South Africa has been severely impacted by COVID-19. Richard, while reflecting on the disruption to the sports calendar as a result of the COVID-19, believes tennis could return sooner than most people had anticipated.
But I just worry about the long-term damage that this crisis and the regulations around this crisis will do to the very fabric of grassroots sports in this country, not just to tennis, but to all sports as well.
In Uganda, last week Tuesday was set as the date for the return of the Uganda Premier League for the final five rounds. But the president of Uganda, Yoweri Museveni, announced an extension of the lockdown by 14 days, which made it uncertain for events that attract mass gathering, including football, to return at least before June. Bernard Bananami, Uganda Premier League CEO, says there's every possibility that the 2019-2020 Uganda Premier League season can still be concluded since the Football Federation of Uganda football calendar is yet to end.
We are still having some hopes of coming back to the stadiums and complete our five matches per team.
And to Algeria, where Algeria international Farid El Milali has apologized after he was arrested for masturbating in public on Monday night. The 23-year-old striker was seen masturbating in the courtyard of his block of flats while looking at a woman who lives on the ground floor. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive week.